Hey, science fans, now you can have all of the Real Science Friday shows on MP3 CD from 2007, 2008, or 2009. Hear Bob and Fred present the compelling scientific evidence that the Earth is young and that there is a creator. Real Science Friday 2007, 2008, and 2009 are each available by calling 1-800-8-NYART. Or you can get the MP3 CDs or the MP3 downloads at kgovstore.com.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
Fred, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Bob. How was your Thanksgiving?
It was really wonderful. What a family God has blessed us with. How's your family?
Oh, the family's great. The wife's out shopping today on the busiest shopping day of the year.
Good for her. That's expected.
Yes, it is.
And, oh, by the way, at Bob and Yurt Live on KGOV.com, we have a special Christmas gift offer for the month until Christmas. So maybe people could check that out.
Oh, they should. It's a lot of really neat stuff.
Yeah, we have something for everyone, literally, for kids, for science lovers, for teenagers, for parents, for just everybody, for Eugenie Scott, for theologians. We've got something for everyone, and it's all listed and easy to find.
That's right, at KGOV.com. So, Bob, it's been, I think, a week since you went on vacation. You went snowboarding. Did you actually do some snowboarding?
I didn't, but our young boys did. We were up in the mountains, the Rockies. We had just the most wonderful time. Three of our seven boys were snowboarding. They all snowboard. But the three young ones, they took lessons at Keystone. What a wonderful, blessed time we had. Fred, it was great. And it's been cold.
Yeah, it's
Where's
been
global
cold.
Warming?
Yeah.
Where's global warming when you need it?
Well, you know, it's still a little early in the ski season, so I was kind of thinking, you know, we've kind of had these snow flurries lately.
Yeah.
And when you were skiing, was it God's snow or was it the man-made snow?
Oh, well, that's a good point because God's snow is so much nicer. I mean, man-made snow is pretty impressive that they could cover these ski runs with snow. It is awesome. Already, there are 2 or 3 feet of snow base on the mountains like Breckenridge and Keystone and all. But God's snow is better.
It is better. How come?
Well, he made it.
He made it.
He designed, the world we live in, the cosmos. And in fact, have you seen photographs of snowflakes?
I have seen photographs of snowflakes. So when you look at them up really close, it's amazing, the shapes.
They're absolutely beautiful. In fact, we should put some of those photos in today's show summary online at kgov.com.
Oh, some of God's snowflakes?
Yeah, they're just so beautiful. And
you should
know
put
what?
Them against the man-made snowflakes.
Oh,
so people can see what they look like.
That's a good idea because man-made snowflakes are, well, they're sort of ugly.
Sort of.
Yeah, so it's so neat to have a world filled with evidence of the hand of our Creator God who has an eye for beauty and a mind for design. And awesome engineering.
Yes, and often scientists actually try to mimic the engineering that they find in nature. Now, unfortunately, many times they don't attribute that to a higher intelligence.
Right.
But that's exactly what it is.
And maybe we'll get to that later in today's show about diatoms.
Yeah, diatoms, those are really neat.
They try to mimic those and use them.
Okay.
But in the meantime, what should we start today's show with?
Well, I actually got a little bit of feedback from our show of 2 weeks ago. We kind of had an inside joke there, and somebody mentioned it.
Oh, was it the Ann one? People, I think a couple people got that joke.
Okay.
But that's about it. That was when we were talking about the gibbons that fly through treetops so fast. It's just amazing how God made them.
They're spectacular.
Yeah, and there are 4 types of apes.
There's 4 types of apes. There's gorillas, chimpanzees, baboons.
And gibbons.
And gibbons?
No, not... And gibbons. But
okay.
That was the inside joke.
That was the inside joke.
We didn't let on what that meant. But why don't you explain why we were chuckling?
Okay, because when you said that and you said and gibbons, it sounded like and gibbons. And Ann Gibbons happens to be a prolific writer for Science Magazine. And a lot of her articles are about man and chimp DNA similarity. She wrote an article about the mitochondrial DNA clock.
Yeah.
Of mitochondrial Eve.
And, you know, why don't we talk about that for a moment? Because when you look at mutations and mutation rates, that's like a clock to see, well, how long ago, if you run the clock backwards, we know how much diversity is in mitochondrial DNA. That's not the DNA in the nucleus of the cell. That's the DNA out in the cell that you inherit only from your mother.
That's right. It's kind of like the power plant of the cell.
That's right. And in the mitochondria, there's DNA in there. And you get that from your mother because a sperm fertilizes the ovum, and the ovum, that cell, has mitochondria in there. So we don't get that from our father. We only get it from our mother.
That's right. And so they looked at that clock. They kind of had scant data, but they went with it anyways.
And this is way back.
Like way back.
The earliest estimates. And they said, if we look at around the world, all the mutational differences, how long ago did the first mitochondrial Eve exist from whom all humans have been born?
Yeah. And they had a number of about 100,000 years, if I remember correctly.
100 or more.
150. Yeah, that was a lot.
Right. A lot. But then they refined it, right? Is that true?
They refined it. And, you know, they actually got more evidence, a lot more. And so when they refined the clock and they recalculated it with the new evidence.
Didn't they actually take some specific human families into account?
Yeah, the Romanovs. People remember them from the Russian Revolution.
Mm.
And so looking at these extra pieces of data that they were able to get forensically, mm-hmm. they calibrated the new clock, and it turned out it was a mere 6,000 years ago.
Mitochondrial Eve, Ann Gibbons wrote in her article. In an evolutionary publication.
In Science Magazine, she wrote that mitochondrial Eve would have been a mere 6,000 years old. And then her very next sentence is, of course, that can't be the case.
That can't be the case, but that's what the science shows. And now, Fred, we have had a blast with that information. The creationists all over the world, scientists, we've just loved it because true science, true observations point to the truth of the Creator God who made us. We live in a young universe on a young earth. Well, they can't let that stand. They just can't let it stand. So now they have recalibrated.
Yeah, here just recently. It took them like 12 years
right.
fighting over this one.
But they did recalibrate, and they say, you know what? Now we have recent data, much better information. And we recalibrate mitochondrial Eve that she existed about 200,000 years ago.
Oh, 200.
200. And, you know, it's funny what they did. It's sort of like the confusion when they first tried this. Now, this is in the American Journal of Human Genetics. But what they did was they were including chimp DNA with human DNA, and they had only small samples, and they were way off.
Because they were assuming that chimps and humans were closely related.
Right. They were assuming
so
that.
They
might as well assume we're closely related to sponges because of the genetic blueprint that God used to create every living thing on Earth. But anyway, Fred, now they've said, well, we recalibrated it and we have much more accurate information. Mitochondrial Eve was not 6,000 years ago. She was 200,000 years ago. And here's how they calculated it.
I bet there was an assumption coming up here.
Right. Well, they did include the complete mitochondrial DNA genomes of over 2,000 human beings. That's cool. From all over the world. That's impressive. Mm-hmm. And then they got some new evidence for the divergence of humans from chimpanzees. They figured it out when humans broke off from chimpanzees. And they said, when we take that into account, we know that mitochondrial Eve didn't live 6,000 years ago. We're back to a couple hundred thousand years ago.
They throw in the assumption that man and chimps share
right.
ancestry.
That's what they did. And they also included the mitochondrial DNA from Casper, the friendly ghost, from Superman and the Boogeyman.
What about Ann Gibbons?
I think she should donates some of her. And now Ann Gibbons is not a joke.
Okay.
She was an inside joke. That's why it was funny when I asked Fred, what are the four types of apes? And you said gorillas, chimpanzees, baboons. And I said, Ann Gibbons. And you said, Ann Gibbons? No, and Gibbons. So anyway, thanks for bringing more people into that punchline. So Fred, Answers in Genesis has a great magazine, Answers, and we have the October through December edition 2010 that we've both been enjoying, and there is quite a story. You really yuck it up when you read this story.
You really yuck it up, huh?
Yeah, you
okay.
do.
Is that the one about, let me guess, yucca moths and a yucca plant?
Yeah, yucca moths. and the yucca plant. Fred, this is an amazing story. It turns out that in the desert regions of North America, there are these yucca moths that have a relationship with the yucca plant. And this is a symbiotic relationship where they both help one another out.
So that's what a symbiotic relationship is.
Yeah.
They benefit each other.
Right. And so help me understand that a little better, and then we'll think about this article.
Okay. Well, helping each other. The first thing that comes to mind is a symbiotic relationship. I have one in my saltwater aquarium at home.
Mm.
I've got clownfish, and there's an anemone. And if anybody saw the movie Nemo, they might remember the clownfish lives in this anemone.
Swims in and out of the
swims
stems,
in and out and this
things,
and that.
Whatever.
So what's interesting about an anemone is that if any other fish gets near it, it'll be stung by the anemone's
tentacles.
Mm. And the clownfish has a substance on its body that doesn't get stung. Mm. And so the clownfish live in an anemone because it protects them from these other big fish. And I've got some big fish in my tank.
Whoa.
And so they make the anemone their home. And it's really cool when I feed the saltwater tank, when I put food in the tank, the clownfish will go up, grab some food, and bring it down to the anemone. And so they serve each other.
Wow.
They each, it's called, a symbiotic relationship.
Wow.
There's a benefit for each of them. The anemone protects the clownfish, provides them a home, and the clownfish feed the anemone.
That is really cool. And we see that with species all over the world. And I'd like to describe this article by Heather Brinson in Answers Magazine about the yucca moth and the yucca plant. Fred, it's absolutely stunning. The yucca flower has a need, of course, for pollination. And the yucca moth wants to dine on the nectar of the yucca flower, but all other insects are excluded, and only the yucca moth is invited, is welcomed, is attracted to the yucca plant. So as a result, the yucca moth doesn't have a lot of competition for a place to lay its eggs. Now, to return the favor, the yucca moth gathers and distributes the yucca flower's pollen. Well, the female moth has specialized mouth parts that allow her to make a ball out of the pollen from the yucca plant, and she carries it then to another suitable flower, and she lays her eggs in the ovary, and then she instinctively shoves the pollen ball into the plant, right where it's needed to fertilize that plant. And then she has a good confidence that no other insect is going to eat her eggs because they're not attracted. And her offspring will eat the yucca seeds once they hatch. And Fred, no other moths do this.
Yeah. And those young moths leave just enough seeds for further pollination, right?
Just enough. In fact, scientists, biologists have figured out that if too many females laid eggs in the same flower, the flower would die, and most of the larvae also would die. So the female moth was designed by God to keep looking until she finds a flower that has little or no female scent, and that's when she lays her eggs, pollinates the flower, and it's just a remarkable symbiotic relationship that is not and cannot be the result of blind chance.
Well, yeah, to put on your evolutionist hat, how do you explain this? How do you explain the yucca moth evolving the knowledge to only go to the yucca plant and the yucca plant at the same time to evolve the knowledge to only let the yucca moth come in because that's going to be the most beneficial for
right.
the yucca plant?
Right, exactly. And when the
do you
moth
think the yucca plants did a study to see, you know, who would be the best at
right. Which insect had the proper specialized mouth parts to make these pollen balls and would be willing to lay her eggs and then shove the pollen ball in there? I mean, it's all just too much. And, you know, evolution is impossible enough when you're trying to evolve a single species or a single-celled organism. Well, then add the complex interdependent ecosystems that fill our world. And now how do you do it? Like, let's say the yucca moth went extinct. Well, the yucca plant might die out.
Absolutely.
Because they provide what ecologists call services. Every species provides services to the ecosystem. They rely on one another. And evolutionists, if one species goes extinct, right, we give them the Darwin Award? No, the evolutionists freak out. They say, look, what's going to happen? We're going to destroy the ecosystem because you cut down a tree, say. Well, how about they believe that there were no species and then one evolved somehow magically without the benefit of natural selection, which couldn't exist until you had a reproducing organism.
Exactly.
Right. And so that species supposedly existed on its own with no other species to provide all the incredible sophisticated services that every species needs to survive.
And we've only given two examples, the yucca plant and the yucca moth and the clownfish and the anemone. Mm. Nature is replete with examples of symbiotic relationships. One of my favorites is the cleaner fish. The shark will only allow a certain, or large fish, including a shark, will allow only a certain type of fish into its mouth, called the cleaner fish, to clean its teeth off. So at what point in the evolutionary process did the cleaner fish think, wow, I'm going to be brave because I'm hungry, and I'm going to go into the shark's mouth.
I'm going to swim right into the shark's mouth.
And it's going to be right at the right time where the shark thinks he needs a tooth, you know, to brush his teeth.
Right.
You know, what are the odds of that?
The shark is going to say, you know, normally I like the taste of these things, but I'm going to be nice, and I'm not going to eat them.
Yeah,
I mean,
and if you read about this, you can go online and read about it. These cleaner fish actually set up stations, so like doctor's offices, that these big fish
come
to them, and they get their teeth cleaned.
Yeah, it's just awesome, isn't it? Isn't God just amazing? Well, speaking of God being amazing, how about these diatoms?
A diatom? What's a diatom?
They're tiny.
Okay.
The thick ones are about the length of, say, a dime, a U.S. dime, 10 cents.
Okay.
The width of a dime. That's a big one. Fred, the little diatoms go down to the size of the finest speck of dust.
Wow.
So these things are small.
And they make for themselves glass houses.
They make glass houses. Now, if you talk to an evolutionist, an atheist archaeologist, they might tell you that mankind invented glass, but that's not true. God was the one who first invented glass, and then he passed on the formula to diatoms. And there are billions of these things all over the world, maybe trillions.
Oh, it's amazing. The article mentions that they build glass houses that resemble chandeliers, cylinders, pillboxes, snowflakes that we talked about earlier.
Yep.
So all kinds of neat
stars and crowns. There's a picture of one diatom in here, and they're so tiny, and they make the most sophisticated designs and with tremendous variety. They say there are 70,000 species of diatoms, and they're colored, and they're just amazing. I mean, Chihuly has nothing up on diatoms.
Chihuly?
You know who Chihuly is?
No.
Chihuly's been following me all over the world.
Okay.
Chihuly is this great artist in blown glass, and his art, his glass works hang in fine hotels, lobbies, museums all over the world.
Oh, wow.
We were in Jerusalem, Fred, and here's a museum on the wall of the old city. And there's Chihuly in the museum. I tell you, the guy follows me everywhere.
And, but I bet you diatoms put him to shame.
You know, Chihuly has nothing up on diatoms. In fact, if there's anyone in this audience who has a Chihuly in their home, I think they should be donating more to Real Science Friday.
Absolutely.
So, right? You got to have money to have a Chihuly. But Fred, God has put these things around the world, not in a few museums, but by the billions. And they're so awesome, and there's something interesting about their fossils. What is it about the fossils of diatoms that seems to contradict the story of the gradual change of evolution?
Well, how old do they say the evolutionists say these things are? Where did they originate?
Well, the fossils, the first fossils, they say, were formed 180 million years
ago. 180 million years ago.
And they were completely different, of course, from the current diatoms.
Yeah, they must be, because that's a long time. That's eons of time to change and become a different...
Right, you got chimps to humans. You got Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Okay.
You got Lucy to Bill Clinton in just a few million years.
We've got 180 million years, so... Yeah, surely they should look something different, but please don't call me Shirley.
So, Fred, but it turns out I was jesting. I was yucking it up because the fossils from 180 million years ago.
Let me guess.
What?
They look just like the living examples we have today.
Oh, come on, Fred. They're almost identical. You know what? That's evolution speak for. They are identical.
Exactly.
They're almost identical to modern diatoms. I mean, that's what they are. They're diatoms. They've been there. They're not 180 million years old. They haven't been evolving for 180 million years. They're just God created them recently. Fred, you remember all the examples of things that are not so old that we've been looking at?
Like
they find proteins and bacteria and fossils that are supposed to be millions or hundreds of millions of years old, even living bacteria. And what do they find in dinosaur fossils now?
They find protein.
They
blood
find
vessels.
Protein molecules, collagen, blood vessels, blood cells, soft tissue in dinosaur fossils, hadrosaurs and T-Rexes. It's just so fun that the world is filled with evidence that it is young.
And here we have another one we can add to your list of not so old things.
Yeah, not so old things. It's just really great. So, Fred, these microscopic ornate diatom shells. This is a treasure of beauty on a tiny scale of creation.
And it's interesting, from this article, we're finding out that scientists want to put these things to good use.
That's right, and they are. Scientists are beginning to use these in nanotechnology, where they use them in electronics and optics. And you know what they're doing? They're taking tiny diatoms and they're heating them up to about 1,600 degrees. And they do that in titanium vapor. Why would they do that in titanium vapor?
I don't know, Bob.
Okay. I'll answer it myself. And they're heating them up in titanium vapor. And the reason they do that is because, as you know, Fred, when the glass vaporizes, the silica, it vaporizes, it's replaced atom by atom with the tough metal ceramics in exactly the same shape as the original diatom. And they're making these extremely hard, tiny, tiny devices that God designed, and they're coming in very handy in human engineering and manufacturing.
Yep, like focusing lenses.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just awesome.
Yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm. All right, so Fred, what we got diatoms and the yucca symbiotic relationship. And we talked about snowflakes and Ann Gibbons.
And what about faith versus reason?
Faith versus reason. What a good topic. Because some people think that faith is the opposite of reason.
They do. The article quotes Mark Twain, who said that faith is believing what you know ain't so.
Yeah, right. Believing what you know ain't so. Faith is believing what you know is not true. Blind faith. And all that is false. God defines faith in the Bible, right?
Yeah, he defines faith in Hebrews 11, verses 1.
And what does God say in his word that faith is?
Faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen.
Faith is the evidence of things not seen. So like gravity, I can't see gravity, but I have evidence that gravity exists. So I have faith in gravity, and that there are properties of the physical realm that God created that things are attracted to one another.
That's right. And the word used for faith is, in the Greek, can indicate a confident expectation.
Hmm.
So it's not a blind faith. You know, evolutionists love to tell you, oh, you can just have your faith.
Right.
They're really ridiculing you and saying, oh, you can go have your blind faith and believe what you want, but it's not true. So that's their version of faith. And even Webster Dictionary defines faith as belief in something for which there is no proof. That's what Webster's Dictionary says.
Yeah, and that's false because we have faith in gravity, and there is proof of gravity. We have faith in electricity. We have faith in the laws of logic. We have faith in reason. We have faith in these things.
Yeah, and the evidence of things not seen. Evidence.
Yeah, so faith is the evidence of things not seen. And, of course, that's a figure of speech. That's a metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have faith in gravity. Well, there's evidence for gravity. The evidence is, for example, if an apple falls out of a tree and it hits you on the head, it doesn't fall up. It falls down. And so there's evidence. Now, that evidence is not faith. The evidence is not faith. Faith is the proper response to the evidence. So
that's
this
right.
is a metaphor,
yeah.
which is normal in human language. Faith is the evidence of things not seen, the substance of things hoped
for.
Right.
Now, Bob, did Jesus expect us to accept him and believe in him without any evidence whatsoever?
Not at all. In fact, Jesus said, if I testify concerning myself, my testimony is not credible because you need evidence. Anybody could say they're the Messiah, anybody.
Yeah.
So he said, you got to look at the evidence. You got to look at the scriptures, the prophecies, my works that I do, and so on.
Yeah, and when John the Baptist was in prison, he actually started having doubts. Here's a great man of faith. He started having doubts, and his messengers went to Jesus, and he asked him, you know, are you truly the Messiah? What did Jesus say? Did he say, ye of little faith? No.
He said, look at the evidence.
Look at the evidence.
Wow. That is so encouraging, Fred. And then, you know, faith and reason work together. God in the Bible says, come, let us reason together. And we Christians can trust logic because we believe, a priori, we believe that there is a creator God. And since that God is a rational God, he created a rational universe for us to live in. But the atheist has no reason to trust the laws of logic. It's circular.
Yeah, so they don't understand why diatoms that they claim are 180 million years old look like diatoms that are living today.
No,
but
they
it
don't.
Sure fits our worldview.
Fred Williams, thanks for this episode of Real Science Friday. And your wife is Christmas shopping, and maybe she could check out at kgov.com our Christmas gift specials and no shipping between now and Christmas. God bless you, Fred.
God bless you, Bob.
kgov.com.
Hey, science fans, now you can have all of the Real Science Friday shows on MP3 CD from 2007, 2008, or 2009. Hear Bob and Fred present the compelling scientific evidence that the Earth is young and that there is a creator. Real Science Friday 2007, 2008, and 2009 are each available by calling 1-800-8-NYART. Or you can get the MP3 CDs or the MP3 downloads at kgovstore.com.
Have you heard of the Plot Manuscript? It's 330 pages, an overview of the entire Bible. People who have read it have said it's helped them understand and enjoy the Word of God. Hi, this is Bob Enyart. I wrote the Plot years ago. We sell it at a money-back guarantee, $49.95 plus shipping and handling. And if you don't feel that you really understand the Bible now, we want to give you your money back. So go online to order it at kgov.com, or call us at 800-8-ENYART. That's 1-800-836-9278.